Psalm 11, and the title of the message is, What Are You Going to Do When Your Foundation Is Shaking? And the premise of the message this morning is this. I want you to be encouraged, and I want to encourage you to stand steadfast in turbulent times. Stand steadfast in turbulent times. I think we have all been pretty much reminded this week, if we have been following the news to any extent, about the tragic earthquake that took place in northern Italy. I don't know if you've seen any pictures or heard any reports about this, but over 200 people died, and many of the structures in this small town in Italy were literally hundreds of years old. They obviously had no building codes in the days 500 or 600 years ago when many of these buildings were built. And so when this earthquake, 6.2 magnitude on the Richter scale, struck the other day, the buildings had no chance. They just simply crumbled and toppled, killing these many people. Most of us probably have never experienced an earthquake of that magnitude before. Now, we've all had experienced earthquakes here in Northwest Washington. Some of them are just little shakers, little tremors, but the earthquake that took place in Italy earlier this week was certainly frightening, and it was also life-changing for a lot of people. Only about 2,500 people live in this town, and so when you have several hundred people that are killed as a result of this, and the aftershocks, I listened to one reporter reporting from the scene, and he said that the aftershocks were absolutely frightening. About 3,000 years ago, a young man took pen in hand to write of another earthquake. I put the word earthquake in quotation marks. It was not a literal earthquake, but it was one that could have the potential to be just as devastating as if it were a physical, literal earthquake. And the young man that I speak of is David, and the words that he penned are in Psalm 11. Psalm 11 fits very neatly and nicely and really quite naturally into his life when he was serving in the court of Israel's first king, Saul, after David had defeated giant Goliath in the battle that we're all familiar with. It was during these years of his life, probably in his early to mid-20s, that David had a number of experiences. Among other things, he married Saul's daughter, Michal, and he became very, very close friends with Saul's son, Michal's brother, Jonathan. It was also during this time that David's popularity was increasing exponentially, so much so that when great exploits were done by David, compared to those that were done by Saul, the crowds would cheer loudly and exuberantly for David. And that, quite frankly, enraged King Saul and provoked him to jealousy. And you read in 1 Samuel that on numbers of occasions, David had to duck when Saul would throw a javelin at him in a fit of anger and hatred. Now, it was during those turbulent times in Israel that David found solace in taking the pen and penning this song, this psalm. And it was not only fitting and appropriate for David's time, but it is equally fitting and appropriate for any generation that is facing some great crisis, whether we're talking about a nation or whether we're talking about individuals. This psalm has great, great truth in it. You know, it's during crises like David writes about here that people are tempted to try to escape, try to run away, do everything that they can to avoid whatever they think is going to happen. David says that there's a better way to approach these foundation quaking experiences in life. In the Lord, David writes, put I my trust. How say ye to my soul, flee as a bird to your mountain? For lo, the wicked bend their bow, they make ready their arrow upon the string, that they may privily shoot at the upright in heart. If the foundations be destroyed, what can the righteous do? The Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. His eyes behold, his eyelids try the children of men. The Lord trieth the righteous, but the wicked and him that loveth violence, his soul hateth. Upon the wicked he shall rain snares, fire and brimstone, and an horrible tempest. This shall be the portion of their cup. For the righteous Lord loveth righteousness. His countenance doth behold the upright. There are numbers of profound truths that I want to explain to you this morning. The song divides itself into three sections. So let's break the psalm down a little bit and see what the Lord has for us this morning. We begin in verses 1 through 3 with David's confession of faith. Trusting God when life is hard. Trusting God when life is hard. And there are two things that stand out in these three verses. And the first is this: David was determined to trust. Isn't it interesting that David began with the solution to the problem rather than stating the problem first? Now, he gets to the problem, but he gives us the remedy. He gives us, you know, this would be like going to a doctor, and before the doctor even examines you, he writes out the prescription. And then he says, oh, okay, so now what's wrong with you? David gives us the prescription, the remedy to these foundation-shaking events that take place in our lives or in the lives of our nation. And so when an individual or a nation is going through certain trials that threaten to bring them down, as David was experiencing here, it oftentimes, as I said a moment ago, it's easier to run. It's easier to run than to take one stand. It's easier to flee than to persevere. It's easier to try to escape rather than to face the issue and ask for God's strength and help. David mentions in this passage of Scripture, right at the very get-go, in the Lord put I my trust. And so he has kind of a debate with himself. He makes the assertion that he's going to trust the Lord, and then he says to himself, how say ye? Notice the word ye there is in the plural. He had some counselors or friends or advisors who recognized the situation that David was facing at this time in his life, and they were telling him to go away. Fly away as a bird to the mountain. He seemingly had no other place to go, no other refuge except to fly away. But he did have a refuge, didn't he? And he states the refuge for you in the very first words of the verse. Proverbs 18, verse 10, I believe it is. The Lord is a strong tower. They that run to it find safety. So David recognized that in spite of the perils and the problems that he was experiencing, he already had a safe retreat. Remember, at this point in David's life, his popularity was growing as Saul's was diminishing. Goliath had been slain. Israel's women were chanting his praises above Saul. One commentator described David as having somewhat of a charismatic personality that was attracting people to him and that could have caused him to easily lead a rebellion against the king, a mutiny of sorts, to try to usurp Saul's authority. We'll see that a little bit later in the psalm. But there's only one problem with all of the counsel and advice that all of David's friends were giving to him, telling him to run. That wasn't God's plan for his life. God's plan wasn't for David to try to escape. God's plan for David was to exalt God, to have God in his rightful place. And I'll say it again, what Rob told Randy last night, it's all about God. And that's the premise upon which David writes this psalm. And this is not the only time in the psalm that David mentions this. You will see that a little bit later in the message. So to run would have taken David right out of God's will for his life. And yet, how many of us are prone to do that very thing? We seem to find it easier to run from our problems and our conditions and our circumstances than to stand and persevere through them. But even as David was confessing his trust in God, even as David was recognizing that he was determined to trust, we discover, secondly, that trouble was developing. Trouble was developing. For lo, the wicked bend their bow, they make ready their arrow upon the string, that they may privily shoot at the upright in heart. Now there's a word in verse 2 that you do not use very often in your everyday discourse and language. It's that word privily. What does that word mean? It means literally in the dark. In the dark. I don't know too many archers that shoot bows and arrows in the dark. Because in the dark, you can't see your target. These enemies were aiming at David's righteousness, the upright in heart. That's why I suspect that the context of this chapter suggests that we do not necessarily have to limit the mention of bows and arrows to literal physical bows and arrows. That what we are really talking about here is a metaphor. A metaphor describing something else. A metaphor that I would suggest to you is describing the malicious, hateful rumors and innuendos and gossip that his enemies were circulating against him. Remember that Saul had no more loyal servant in his realm than David, at least in the beginning. But it didn't take long for Saul's sympathizers to begin to realize that David posed a tremendous threat to Saul's throne and authority. And so they started the whisper campaign. And David couches this whisper campaign using this analogy of arrows, barbs that were being shot. And so they start this whispering campaign, and the arrows are laden with poisonous gossip and innuendo. And they would say things perhaps like this to Saul: "Watch out for David. Don't turn your back on David. One of these days, David's going to try to usurp your throne. Be careful. Watch out." And you know, if you tell a person a lie often enough, they begin to believe it themselves. So don't lose your place here, but turn to Psalm 52. And let me show you what I believe would be a parallel to this. Psalm 52. Beginning in verse 1. "Why boastest thou thyself in mischief, O mighty man? The goodness of God endureth continually. Thy tongue deviseth mischief like a sharp razor, working deceitfully. Thou lovest evil more than good, and lying rather than to speak righteousness. Thou lovest all devouring words, O thou deceitful tongue." So I think that's what David probably had in mind here, was all of these false rumors that were being started against David to rile Saul up even more and to make him more mad at David. And you know what? They were all aimed at destroying David and his future. So at this point in the psalm, back to Psalm 11, David gets to the heart of the matter in verse number 3. "If the foundations be destroyed, what can the righteous do?" This is really the heart of the message of the psalm. So we need to understand two significant words in the verse. The first word is the word foundations. Because what David does now is he uses the metaphor of architecture, of building, to describe what was taking place in Israel. So what is David referring to? I believe that the word foundations here is David's metaphor for social order within a nation. Social order within a nation. The settled order of things within a nation. So David is comparing the social order to being the very foundation upon which a nation is built and based. When the foundation of a structure is damaged, like what happened in Italy this past week, the entire building is at risk of collapsing. The foundation is the key to the stability of the whole structure. And if the foundation is eroded through an earthquake, then the whole structure will inevitably implode. The word destroyed. What shall the righteous do if the foundations are destroyed? Is used here to speak of a violent upheaval, such as an earthquake. A quaking. And in this case, if our interpretation of the foundation is accurate, then the upheaval here is the undermining of the social and moral values and civil order of a nation. They are being obliterated as a result of this metaphoric earthquake is concerned. So the moral values of David's beloved Israel before his very eyes were beginning to crumble. And the same is no less true of our beloved America. I want to be clear about something here. The foundation, the moral foundation of a nation primarily consists of seven things. And if you're taking notes this morning, let me read these off to you, and I'll try to do it slowly enough so that you can write them down. The foundation of society is rooted in seven things. Here they are. Number one, law. Number two, order. We've heard one of the presidential candidates the last couple of weeks talking about being the law and order candidate. This is what is being described here. Number three, truth. Number four, justice. Number five, morality. Number six, decency. And number seven, the integrity of the citizens of the particular nation. If any or all of those seven foundational principles are undermined either in society at large or in my or your personal lives, then the society or your personal life will come crashing down. And don't for one minute think in your personal life that you can violate one of these principles and be the exception to the rule. I read an article this week that goes along with the sermon series I've preached here a number of times, Harvest Laws for Holy Living. And the article, the premise of the article was this, that it is a myth to believe that we can sin and not suffer as a result. That we can sin and there be no consequences. That is a myth. But it is nonetheless a principle that is gaining traction even in the church, that we can sin and get away with it somehow. So what do we see happening in our beloved America today? We see the quaking of these seven foundational truths. Humanism, evolution, libertarianism, secularism are now the prevailing moods in the schools, in the government, in the media, and increasingly even in the church. I believe there is a concerted attack on the part of the enemies of our foundational truths in America. It's being waged against everything that is decent and moral and Christian in our culture. The foundations are being rocked on a Richter scale that is unprecedented in the history of our nation. You see it on every hand. Abortion. Over 50 million precious children murdered since 1973. So-called same-sex marriage. And one church denomination after another church denomination is caving in to this new view of marriage. Who here would have thought 5 years ago that the government would require men and women to use each other's restrooms? America, has it gone past the tipping point? So David's question in verse 3 really amounted almost to a cry of desperation and despair. It seemed like he was hopeless. Now, we know that he wasn't. And yet he felt compelled to ask the question, what could he do? Where could he turn? The social and spiritual implications, not to mention the political ramifications for Israel at that time and for America today, were very serious. Israel was decaying from within, as well as being threatened by her enemies at the borders. And the one man who could possibly turn it all around, the one man who could, quote, make Israel great again, was the man who was writing these words, even David. But he was being systematically marginalized, neutralized, intimidated, insulted, isolated by the enemies of the realm who were bent only on maintaining their political power and advantage. So, what were the righteous supposed to do? Let me say it another way. What are you going to do when your foundation is shaking? Well, we don't have to wait very long for David to answer the rhetorical question, because in verses 4 and 5, we discover a second great truth. The first one was the confession of faith, trusting God when life is hard. The second one is the certainty of faith, trusting God who is our help. It's interesting that in verse 4, David returns to his original premise. You remember what the original premise was in verse 1? In the Lord put I my trust. Verse 4, the Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. His eyes behold, his eyelids try the children of men. The Lord. You see, it's the Lord, the Lord, the Lord. That was his focus. He put his trust and confidence in God, no matter what the circumstance, no matter what the problem, be it individual or international. As far as David is concerned, God was more than sufficient. And in order to bolster the certainty of his faith, he offers us three amazing glimpses of God in verses 4 through 6. You could call them axioms because they know no exceptions. So let me repeat this. Though we may not believe these things, though we may doubt these three truths, our unbelief and our doubt does not change the truth or the reality of these three truths that I'm now going to give you. Do you understand that? It doesn't matter how we view these three truths. They are true regardless. The question is going to be, at the end of the day, are these three truths going to be realities in your life? Are they going to be realities in your life tomorrow and next week and next month? Because these three realities are what we have to hold on to when our foundation is quaking. So let's take a look at the three great truths about God, and they are all about God. Number one, David affirmed God's sovereignty. And he says to us, in a sense, look where God is sitting. And where is he sitting? The Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. Now, be honest with yourself about what I am now going to say. Be honest with yourself. We tend to judge appearances and circumstances on the moment that they're taking place. We do not have the long view in mind as we should. Our situation seems so desperate that God seems many miles away from us, so distant from us, so seemingly unconcerned, not interested in the slightest about what I am going through at the moment. Has God abdicated the throne? Is he vacant? Is he on vacation? As our nation continues to slide into hell, why doesn't God intervene? Why doesn't God step in and reverse the slide that we are seeing before our very eyes? Evil is growing with intensity. And God seems to be silent. The same is true when you and I are going through personal foundation tremors in our own lives. We cry out to God, and the cry seems to fall on deaf ears. And that's because we have a problem. And here's the problem. We forget who God is, and we forget where God is. Where is God in the midst of your problem? Where is he? Well, David tells us that he's ruling and reigning on his throne in heaven, a glorious throne. And he has never stopped reigning and ruling. Do you remember in the year, now I know you don't remember because you weren't there, but you remember the passage in the year that King Uzziah died in Isaiah 6. What did Isaiah say? What did Isaiah say and see? I saw the Lord high and lifted up, sitting on his throne. David had the same view of God in the midst of the moral and spiritual collapse that was taking place in his own nation. You see, from where God sits, God has many options at his disposal to deal with the spiritual and personal earthquakes that take place in our lives. You know, God's very versatile in dealing with these things. Let me suggest two of them to you. One option is that God could bring revival. God could bring revival to America. I am not talking about the revival of the lost. Because the lost can't be revived if they haven't been vived in the first place. Revival never pertains to the lost. It always pertains to the saved, to the people of God who are responsible for the moral and spiritual condition and direction of a nation. That's why Peter tells us that when judgment begins on a nation, where will it begin? It will begin with the household of faith. Because God doesn't primarily hold the unsaved responsible for the direction of the nation. He holds his people responsible for the direction of the nation. We are to be the true social and spiritual conscience of the country, not the unsaved. And if God's people are not acting as the spiritual and social conscience of America, then America will not survive. It's just that simple. America will not survive. So let me repeat something that I said earlier in the message. The foundation of any nation rests upon seven truths. I want to repeat them. Law, order, truth, justice, morality, decency, and the integrity of its citizens. And if those seven things, or any of those seven things, are undermined in a society or in our personal lives, your personal life or your nation will come crashing down. So to say that we need revival amongst the people of God today is a huge understatement. That's one of God's options. God selected that option, incidentally, in the 18th century following the French and American revolutions. There was a decline both in Europe, on the continent, as well as in America, of spiritual Christianity. Many assumed that Christianity was dead. But in the 19th century, God allowed four great revivals to take place that impacted the culture, the church, and society at large, both in Europe and in the United States. Christianity once again became an integral part of society's affairs and government's affairs. Could it happen again in post-Christian America? God is sovereign. But there's another option that God has. And the other option that God has is retribution and ruin. You see, God could just let it all go. He could rapture his people out of the world and let the encroaching evil run its course. But I want you to understand something, brethren. Whichever option God chooses, God is still on the throne. He is still in control. He is sovereign. David's affirmed a second truth, and that is God's scrutiny. And he tells us, look at what God sees. Beginning in the middle of verse 4. His eyes behold, his eyelids try the children of men. The Lord trieth the righteous, but the wicked and him that loveth violence, his soul hateth. Now this is an interesting reference to eyes and eyelids. If I take my glasses off, especially at night, by the way, when I take my glasses off now, you are all a blur. Okay? Now at nighttime, when I don't have my glasses on and it's dark in the room, I have a clock radio on the bedstand next to me. And when I look at it in the middle of the night, the numbers are blurry, even though I'm fairly up close to it. However, if I squint like this, what I do is I have the ability to bring the numbers into focus. You know, I wouldn't have to wear glasses if I could go around like this all the time. You know, like, who was it? Mr. Magoo? You remember Mr. Magoo? Okay, some of you don't know who Mr. Magoo is, but nonetheless, that was Mr. Magoo, okay? So, when you squint your eyelids, you're taking a closer look at something. So David is telling us that far from being apathetic, God is not apathetic at all. God is not indifferent to what's happening around us. God was actually taking a closer look. He was scrutinizing. And he was using David's situation in this scrutiny in Saul's court to test sinners and saints alike. So far from being oblivious to what was going on, God was looking very precisely, very closely, squinting to get a better look, using human terms, obviously. So God constantly probes the hearts of men. And that brought David to his third great truth about God. And he affirmed God's severity. Because he said the Lord was about to send something. Verse 6. Upon the wicked he shall rain snares, fire, and brimstone, a horrible tempest. This shall be the portion of their cup. Now, brethren, if you don't get anything else out of this message today, please get this. No one can escape personal accountability to God. I don't care who you are, no one can escape personal accountability to a holy and righteous God. Do you know what David is doing here? He's praying what is referred to as an imprecatory prayer. An imprecatory prayer is a prayer in which you call down God's judgment and justice upon an enemy. Now, let me caution you about something. And if I were to ask for a show of hands today, most of you would probably raise your hands. Have you ever been tempted to pray a prayer like that to somebody that you don't like? Don't raise your hand. You better be very careful. You better pray that prayer under two conditions. Number one, that you pray it unselfishly. And number two, that you pray it for the glory of God. If you can't meet those two qualifications, I would suggest you better not pray it, because God just might take you at your words. And that is very serious. It's a simple way of recognizing that God and sin cannot coexist together. God and sin cannot coexist together. God must punish sin or cease to be a holy God. Old Testament examples of this kind of judgment are frequent. Sodom and Gomorrah, the flood of Noah. John Phillips, in his commentary on the Psalms, says, David could clearly see that sins which corrupt the very foundations of society simply cannot be ignored by God. And then you see those words, rather startling words, in verse 6. Upon the wicked he shall rain snares. You know what a snare is? It's a trap. And God is going to rain down traps upon the wicked. The idea there is that when the judgment of God is falling on an individual or a nation, God oftentimes so entangles the person or the nation in their own evil and wickedness that they can't escape it. And they become the recipients of the resulting judgment. You want some Old Testament examples of that? How about Pharaoh? How about Haman in the book of Esther? So we've looked at the confession of faith, trusting God when life is hard, the certainty of faith, trusting the God who is our help. Lastly today, the conquest of faith, trusting the God who gives us hope. So David begins the psalm with trust. He ends the psalm with hope. For the righteous Lord loveth righteousness. His countenance doth behold the upright. Now, Rob, if you look at verse 7, I think it reads a little differently, especially the last phrase. And I believe it reads something like this. The upright shall behold his face. Which is the exact opposite of what the verse says. But I think is a more accurate reflection of the Hebrew. Instead of it meaning that God's face is going to see the righteous, it means rather that the righteous are going to see God. Hope. Hope. Guess what, folks? God's people win in the end. And God has a glorious final reward when we will be able to gaze upon the one who is so lovely, the one who is so glorious. And even though your present circumstances may look bleak and dreary and dark and foreboding, your future is full of the hope of God. It is as bright as the promises of God. We have a magnificent future in store for us when in that day we shall see him. And it will be worth all that we have experienced and endured. William Cooper captured the sentiments of Psalm 11 in a hymn that we sing in our church here, but maybe we didn't tie it in with Psalm 11. But I want you to listen to the words of this psalm, or this song. God moves in a mysterious way his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. Deep in unfathomable mines of never-failing skill, he treasures up his bright designs and works his sovereign will. Ye fearful saints, fresh courage take. The clouds ye so much dread are big with mercy and shall break in blessings on your head. Judge not the Lord by feeble sense, but trust him for his grace. Behind a frowning providence, he hides a smiling face. His purposes will ripen fast, unfolding every hour. The bud may have a bitter taste, but sweet will be the flower. Blind unbelief is sure to err and scan his work in vain. God is his own interpreter, and he will make it plain. So as you face the tremors of life, those metaphorical earthquakes that shake the very foundation of your life, I hope that you will find hope and strength and courage in a sovereign God. And may we as never before be able to give a biblical answer to the question, what are you going to do when your foundation is shaking? May we stand fast in turbulent times for God's glory. Let's pray.